Hello and welcome to the podcast Sunsets and Rainbows. I'm your host, Agnes Jensen, and this is the podcast where we talk about life, loss, faith, and motherhood, and some more things that are usually brushed under the rug. Hello, everyone. I'm really glad you stopped by for yet another episode of this podcast. As you know, we've been covering a lot of baby loss stories, and today I'm going to be sharing my own personal journey of baby loss. And if you have been following me on Instagram or any other social media platform, you would know that we had a baby boy called Elliot, who unfortunately was still born in the year 2020. And after 4 years, I'm sitting down here to record his story. This is for my future self or for anyone who is going through the loss to know about what it is to go through a baby loss journey. I've recorded this intro almost 10 times now, and I've told a story many, many times, and still my voice breaks. It brings me to tears. But out of all this, there is so much love. Love that doesn't have anywhere to go. Now we have our daughter, who is 2.5 years old. She's our rainbow baby. She has brought so much joy, and babies do not replace babies. And her journey is very different, and I'll get back to that in some other episode. Today, I'm going to be covering Elliot's story in two parts. In this episode, we'll talk about his pregnancy and his birth story and the time that we spent with him. And in the next episode, I'll cover the postpartum journey, the funeral, and the early grief, and how we navigated that. If you're here for the first time and if you had a loss, I really want to give you a warm hug to say that you're not alone on this journey. And if you're listening to this episode for your friend or your family, again, I want to give you a warm hug saying that by listening to other people's story, you really learn to support others in their grief. I don't want this podcast to be one-sided. If you're new, please in the comments write where you're from and what is your story, and I would really like to get to know you. If you want me to talk about different topics, also please leave those in the comments, and let's get started. To set an early context to our story, who are we? Who am I? I'm Agnes. I am born and raised in India, Tamil Nadu. I'm raised with Christian Pentecostal faith. And why do I say about these things? Because these has effect in how I handled my faith and grief, the questions that came with the journey, and people's responses, and all those sorts of things. I moved to Denmark in 2015 for an internship, which was supposed to be a year. At the end of the year, I almost knew that I want to stay in this country, and another opportunity popped up in the same company that I was, and I was hired full time, and then I got to stay in this country. By the time, I also have met my now husband, Yepi, and I'll keep our introduction love story for another day, but it's quite interesting how we met at work, and our love journey began. And in the year 2017, we got married. And we started trying for a baby. And I always knew that I had troubles. I have PCOS and I have autoimmune diseases, including thyroid, which affects your metabolism and hence my menstrual health has not been in a very good state, to say. Although we knew that there could be some problems in getting pregnant, we were still hopeful as a young couple. We were still trying, and after a year we realized, okay, it's been a year, so we have to go get ourselves checked and see if we can get further help to get pregnant. And when we went to the doctors, they gave us a few different options, and starting with we could start with the IUI, intrauterine insemination, and we could do that for 3 times. And if those 3 times failed, then we'll be referred to IVF. In Denmark, you should have already tried for a year in order to be eligible for getting help. And at this point, we have already tried for a year. And also, since there was underlying conditions, they actually told us we could start the treatment straight away. And so we started our fertility treatments journey. And the first round, we were very naive, like, okay, what could go wrong? I was pumped with Clomil, and that's the hormones that they give you in order for the eggs to grow. And they closely monitor with scans, ultrasound scans. So they monitor like how the eggs are developing, and if you're responding to the hormones, they bump it up. If you need more, or they reduce it, and then you get some injections also close to ovulation for the eggs to mature and for the ovulation process to happen. And on the ovulation day, the 1 day before, then when the egg size is correct, then they inject the sperm that they have collected, and then the waiting game starts for 2 weeks. And at the end of 2 weeks, you take a pregnancy test and see if this is, and if you're pregnant or not, otherwise you get your period. We were very naive how this process was going to be. First of all, we didn't tell anyone that we were going through fertility treatment. We were really ashamed of telling anyone that we were getting fertility treatments. And as soon as we began this journey, the process was so mechanical. The dream of how you want to conceive, it completely vanishes. It strips away the intimacy of the relationship. It strips away the innocence, and it strips away the enjoyment that comes with a new couple enjoying their relationship. And I really wish I heard more stories about infertility, of how lonely this journey can be, how isolating and how cold this journey can be, because everything felt so mechanical. You take the medicine, you inject yourself, you're scanned after scanned after scanned, and then you give a sperm sample, and the doctors are involved. It happens in a medical room. It happens in a clinic. I don't think I was ready for how cold and mechanical this process is going to be. And so that was the first round, and I was so naive that what could go wrong? Like, okay, the egg is there, the sperm is there, they meet, bam, you're going to get pregnant. And that's not what happened. The first round failed, And then it hit me like a truck. Okay, this is not a one-time thing. I really hope the next round works. And we did the next round, and that failed too. And we got one more shot at it, and I had to, in my absolute power, I had to do everything that we can. And very few of my best friends knew what we were going through. And I had a best friend who really encouraged me to do Whole 30, a diet program called Whole 30, where you cleanse your body eating very whole foods. We did the Whole 30 program, and then we went to Rome for a trip when we started trying for a baby, and then going through fertility treatments, the process of getting a diagnosis. Everything has left us so drained that we thought, okay, a trip would do us good. And we went on a week trip to Italy, Rome. I fell in love with the ruins, and it was so beautiful. And this also reminds me of when I posted a picture from this Rome trip, one commented like, oh, beautiful couple still in their honeymoon phase. But we only knew what was the story behind that photos. What looked like a romantic trip for someone else was our survival, our attempt to renew our relationship and to catch a breath from the fertility treatments and to find ourselves again. And this is what people see, like in social media, people see we are happy, we went to Rome, they are looking at the pictures. But in reality, what is going on is we are fighting for survival. And that's also the reason why we should be very kind and not believe everything that we see in social media, because we might be portraying happy smiles that we have, but in reality we might be going through really hard journeys. And so fast forward, after this trip, after the dieting, I really felt good, because in Rome we really walked a lot, and when we came back I really felt I was ready. And then we went in for the last round of IUI, and this round, to our surprise, it worked. And at the end of this round, and when I took the test for the very first time, I saw two lines. I also knew the 1 in 4 pregnancy ends in miscarriage. I knew the statistics. But I was still hopeful. Anyone who goes into the pregnancy always thinks that this is going to be okay. You are hopeful, even though cautiously you know the numbers, you're still hopeful to say, okay, that this pregnancy is going to be okay. The hard part is over. Now we can just relax. When you have gone through fertility treatments, the fertility clinic gives you a scan at 8 weeks. And we saw a very strong heartbeat. And then we were sent to the normal doctors, who then refers you to the midwife and the pregnancy department in the big hospitals. And so we saw a very healthy heartbeat at 8 weeks. And then we hit the 12 weeks mark. Everything was good. I had very strong nausea. I had very strong symptoms. I was throwing up, and I couldn't eat meat for a few months, and all healthy signs of pregnancy. And we hit 12 weeks, and then 20 weeks. During 20 weeks, my friend who suggested the diet, she's also a photographer, and I asked her to help with the pregnancy photo shoot. She took a few pictures when I was around 8 weeks, 9 weeks, when we just knew. And at that time, I had the strong urge to start a website. And that's when I also like, I thought at one day when we have a baby, then I'm going to tell my story to the world. And and until then, I will be writing about some blogs on faith and some motivational blogs. And I'm going to write some recipes. And that's when I actually started my blogging journey. And for the blogging journey, my friend helped to take some pictures. And the secret in those pictures were I was 8 weeks pregnant. And I told myself that when we announced this pregnancy, then we would like declare the goodness of God, how he has helped us to be pregnant and how grateful we are for this journey. And 20 weeks, we went to Tivoli with a small pumpkin and we did a beautiful pregnancy announcement. We took some really nice pictures and our friend helped again. And it turned out to be really great. And my pregnancy announcement started something like this. When I wrote those words, over countless prayers and tears, now we have the blessing along those lines. The voice of me would say, like, how neatly I was trying to tie a bow on the top of the suffering that we were going through. Even though those months, those years was horrible, the waiting was horrible, the treatment was cold and mechanical, I still tried to put a bow on the top saying that over countless prayers and tears, now we have received the blessing. And that was okay. That is okay. And I know I have grown. At that time, I was still ashamed. I was still not ready to tell my story completely. I wanted to focus on just the positive outcome. And so that's what we did. During 27 weeks, we did a private scanning and we saw like everything was perfect. Then it was Christmas. We celebrated the Christmas. We bid farewell to the second trimester and entered the third trimester. And Elliot was due on my birthday. He was due on the 25th of March. And I was like telling the midwives, oh yeah, I'm going to share my birthday with my son. And I really don't want to. I hope he chooses his own birthday and so on. We celebrated the Christmas at my in-laws. And when we came back, everything was still perfect. And we went to the 30 weeks checkup, 32, with the nurse. And during the nurse's appointment, there was some indication that she didn't really couldn't locate where exactly he was. His position, she wasn't clear. She had no problems of the measurements and stuff. She still said I was measuring correct and she was able to listen to the heartbeat. And at 32 weeks, it was still all right. And the next appointment that you have is at week 36 plus one. One day before this appointment, I knew like Elliot was moving every day. Without fail, like he was always active. He was such an active baby. And until this point, everything seemed to be textbook perfect. There was no alarms. There was no nothing. One day, the night before the appointment, around dinner time, I thought to myself, I haven't felt him move all day. He's such an active baby. And then I tried to Google stuff. That's when I found out I can drink some orange juice and lay on my side to see if he moves. And that's the thing. Whenever I tried to lay down or get up, I felt movements. And I was like, is those really movements? He usually wiggles. He's like, there are some kicks and those are not there. The movements that I feel now is from side to side. And the worst thing about the first pregnancy is you have no experience to look back what you have no experience of how pregnancy could be. You have no experience, first-hand experience of how movements should be. And there is no book says that you should be counting kicks. And as a first pregnancy, you are just hopeful and read the good part of the book. Never go through the complications. And as long as like my blood pressure was right, I didn't have gestational diabetes, so there was nothing alarming that came up in the previous weeks. So you're just, never in my wildest dream I was thinking about that he could have passed away. This is also something that always happened, was as I gotten bigger, I couldn't really lay down and sleep, a proper sleep. So in the sofa that I always like sat and slept. So I fell asleep on the couch after dinner, after doing this. And me and Yepe are talking about this. And when I woke up, it was 2 in the middle of the night. And Yepe is asking me to go back to bed. So, and then I told him, I feel really something off because he hasn't moved. He hasn't moved all day. And then we kind of, we took a torchlight. We put it on my tummy to try to give some light to see if he responds. And there was nothing. And I still drank something more cold, and there was nothing. And we are talking about, it's almost 2, like it's 2 in the morning, and we have a midwife appointment when we wake up at 8 o'clock.
Sure.
So could we wait until 8, or should we go call the doctor now? And then we decided actually to wait and then go to the midwife appointment. There's a mixed feeling here. I both regret and do not regret, because even though I didn't get a good sleep that night, that was the best sleep that I got for the next 2 weeks. And we went to the doctor's appointment, the midwife's appointment next morning. And I started telling my midwife. She asked me how I was doing. And I said, well, I'm not really sure, because I had a headache a couple of days ago. And there was something, I feel a bit weird, because I don't feel as wiggles. The whole yesterday, I didn't feel as wiggles. And he does this movements from side to side, but not, I don't feel him move. Like his wiggles and kicks are gone. The very first thing that she said was, oh, like you are 36 weeks now and you are heavily pregnant. As the pregnancy progresses, the baby runs out of space. And hence, their moments feel different, and you don't feel their wiggles. And to anyone that is pregnant now, I would scream from the bottom of my heart and say that babies should move until the birth. Yes, the moments feel different, but it gets stronger. It gets bigger, and never it stops. And that is something that unfortunately I have to learn the hard way. It's really unfair that there is no proper education that is done on counting kicks, or how important it is to keep track of the movements of the baby. And yeah, and the midwife says this, and she says, yeah, let's give it a check. I lay on the table and Yepe is next to my head. She put the hand Doppler to find the heartbeat. She looks and she looks and she looks. She couldn't find the heartbeat. I started seeing her face going pale, and she's like, the baby's in a very stubborn position, and she tries to like feel my stomach, and then she tries to measure. When she measures, she really, her face started dropping, and she says, you are measuring quite some weeks behind. You are measuring almost 3 weeks behind. And I was like, I went to the checkup at 32 weeks, and the nurse heard the heartbeat, and she measured everything fine. She wasn't sure about the baby's position, but everything was fine. At this point, I think I started going into shock. I still didn't know the magnitude of the words that she cannot find the heartbeat. And she says, the baby is in the very stubborn position. I really can't locate the heartbeat. I need the help of ultrasound. In Denmark, the hospitals are like this. There is a department of midwives, and then there is a department for ultrasound scans where there's also like specialized doctors. And she asks me if I could walk, or do you want a wheelchair so you can sit? And I was like, oh, what's wrong with me? Like, I can still walk. But as I walked, I could feel how heavy those steps were. And my mind started going blank. The only thing that I've been telling in my head was like, please be okay. Please be okay. And I was holding Yip's hand so tightly, and we went into this ultrasound department. And the ultrasound technician, she started, who's also another midwife, she started looking for the heartbeat with the ultrasound, and she located the heart. And she says, I don't see a heartbeat for the baby. They asked me if we knew the gender, and we said it's a boy. And she said, I couldn't see the heartbeat. He died, she said in Danish. I screamed into the wall. I could see the wall. I screamed into the wall, Jesus, not now. And Yeppe was asking the technician to, can you please try check again? Can you please try check again? She said, let me go find another technician. And the midwife is there. The student who was together with the midwife, she was also there. And the other doctor came in. And this time a doctor. And the specialist doctor, she's trying to do the ultrasound again to see what was going on. And then she also saw that there was no heartbeat. There's usually another screen where we can also look, but in this room, the other screen wasn't there. So she turned her screen and she pointed out, so this is his ribs, this is his heart. This is where we should be able to see the heartbeat, and it is still. And I could see there is some fluid around the heart. So our guess is maybe it has been some hours or it has been some days. We do not know. But he is dead. And again, there was a lot of wailing, and I was still in shock. I said, okay, can you make him come back? I didn't know the magnitude of the word he died. It's still, for me, like, can you make his heart beat again? I asked this question, and she was like, sorry, we cannot do that. And there was a lot of crying, and the midwives, they held my hand. They also cried with me. And one of the midwives, she said, I've been midwife for so many years, and I will never forget you and your son. And And this is my story and this is my experience, that even in those moments, with the Danish healthcare, what we received was compassion. And the news was delivered to us in a way that with so much compassion, and the midwives were using his name. They were holding my hands, they were crying together with me. And the doctor said, we're going to give you a few minutes and we're going to come back in again and explain you what's going to happen from now on. So after a few minutes, the doctors came in and they came with a lot of pamphlets, and they said, now there's going to be a lot of information that they're going to give us, and we will have to make a lot of decisions, hard decisions, in the next few days, and they're going to make a plan for the birth. And I was like, he's not supposed to come in for another 4 weeks. I'm not ready for giving birth. How do I give birth to a child who is dead within me? How can I give birth to death? At that moment, it sounded so morbid, even though I knew that Elliot is loud. It's just that moment you cannot think of anything else than I'm carrying death. And so we asked for a C-section, and the EP asked, can you not give us a C-section? And they said, unless there is complications, they recommend to do this via vaginal birth. And the doctors promised, I'll give you all the painkillers and all the pain medications to make this as comfortable as possible for you. But unless there is complications, we recommend doing this through vaginal birth. And they told me that we are going to give you a pill right now, which will start the process of abortion. And at that time, like, what I'm getting there is an abortion pill, is to get the baby out of my system. And yes, at 36 weeks, the technical term, the medical term for it, is it's still abortion. And so technically, I'm getting an abortion, and I was given this pill which starts the process, and we were told to go home and collect the things that we need because it's going to be quite some days. They said it can take anywhere, since it's your first birth, it can take from hours to days. And they couldn't really say how many days it could take. They asked us to prepare for a few days. And in those pamphlets, there was information about what happens when you have to give birth to a baby that died. There was a pamphlet from a lost nonprofit organization. They have collected similar stories. There were stories of baby loss from different gestation period and infant loss, and how does early grief feel, and some contact that helps in the aftermath of the loss. And we were asked to go home and collect our things and come back and get admitted the very next day. And they told us, if we need help with the funeral, there was a hospital chaplain. They asked if they want the hospital chaplain to take care of it, or if we will do our own funeral. There were decisions to be made if we want to cremate the baby, or if we want to bury him. I mean, it felt so wrong to talk about that. He's still in the room, he's still within me, and to make plans for his funeral when he's not even born is I really don't even have a word to say how I felt at that moment, how we felt at this moment, to make plans for your baby's funeral when he's not even born. And I really wouldn't wish it even on my enemy to have such an experience. And we went home. On the way home, we also wrote in our family group, in the Danish family group, Yippee wrote that saying that we lost our baby boy, he died. And I also wrote to my Indian family that he died. And the calls are starting to come in. They were asking, and I've been sobbing on the phone calls. And my mom was supposed to come for the delivery, and she's like, they cannot get immediate visas to Denmark, so they cannot be there either. And we told our Danish family, like, we still wanted to come. We told my father-in-law and my mother-in-law, like, they could still come for when we get admitted in the hospital. So when we got admitted in the hospital, they were on their way from Northern Jutland to come to Copenhagen, where we live. And this was happening. And when we went home, we really didn't know what to do. We turned on the TV, and I wrote to my best friends, a couple of my best friends, saying that Elliot has passed away. And hearing that, they immediately came. And my friend, she cooked dinner with what we had in the fridge. They both stayed that evening and they prayed. I don't really remember the prayer, but I think we prayed for strength for the next few days. And that night when I went to bed, I looked to my left and saw the crib that my father-in-law made for the babies of the home. Like, it's the family crib, and it was all made ready, and I couldn't just look at that, and I tried to turn around, and there was this big feeling of I'm carrying death, and I couldn't close my eyes, I couldn't fall asleep, and me and Yippee, we both struggled to fall asleep that night, thinking, and we packed a few things that we would need for the hospital pack. And at that point, I haven't even prepared my hospital bag. I just threw a few things in. And in the living room, there is a pile of clothes that are being washed and being folded. And I've been sorting out a huge pile of clothes. And those clothes are still there. I couldn't look at those clothes. And we were so numb and still in shock. Not knowing what the next few days will bring. And then we went to the hospital the very next day to get admitted. And they gave me a couple more pills to swallow, and they started inducing the labor. And they tell me this can take from hours to a few days. And they get settled us in a labor ward. And it was, and in Denmark, I believe I was in the bereavement suit, or at least away from the other maternity wards. So the wing that I was in, it was quite empty. I was the only one in that wing, and we were given a room. And at this point, I wasn't taking any pictures, even though we brought the camera with us. It felt so morbid, or it felt so unfair to take any pictures at that point. And I've been laboring, and the contractions started kicking in. And there's more doctors coming in, and the doctors who came in are still giving us the information about if we want to do a burial or if we want to do a cremation. And another hard decision that we have to take is, do we want an autopsy or not? And obviously we want to know the reason why he passed away. So yes, we agreed to an autopsy, and they told us how he'll be handled. He'll be handled with kindness. And they asked if I had any questions. And I asked, how will he look when he is born? And she said, the midwife said, he will look like a baby. He might be a bit discolored because we don't know how long he has been gone. So he might be discolored. His lips might be dark. Other than that, he will look as he is. And I asked her those questions and we were just numb. And I wanted to remember all these things because I knew in those shock, I wouldn't remember what was going on. And I wanted to remember what is happening. And I've been writing in a diary what things people are saying, what is the doctor saying. As I was having contractions, as I was laboring, I was writing down everything that has been happening. And at this point, Yeppe's parents also arrived from northern Denmark. And then and we were having a conversation about how we should be doing the funeral. My father-in-law is a very good handyman and he's a good carpenter who does beautiful things with wood, like, for example, the family crypt, as I said earlier. And he just said, I will make the kiste, which is coffin in Danish. And he just slammed his head on the bed I was laying in. And the grief that we felt as a family at that moment, I'm really glad that they could take part and come visit us in the hospital, and that he agreed to make the coffin. It was quite nice to have them together with us in the hospital, and they went home. And as the neighbor continued, I got some pills and I got morphine. For the painkillers, and also that morphine didn't really help. Yeah, after the morphine, they offered me epidural, and I refused to get epidural because at that moment, I feel like I wanted punishment, and to feel the pain is to have the punishment for myself. Of obviously, at that point, I started feeling guilt. That night when we were preparing to come to the hospital, my dad was together with this Indian doctor, and the very first question she asked me was, did I travel anywhere recently? And did I roll in my sleep? And the questions that she asked, like, what did I do in the past few days? Did I do any stressful stuff? And then there has been blaming that I've been working too much. I've been taking my driver's license. And there's like already I'm going through in my head. Already there's a million questions running in my head. Where did I go wrong? What did I do? What could I have done to prevent this? The guilt I felt those moments. I felt I needed the punishment. And so I was refusing to get the epidural. And the doctors, like the midwives, they convinced me, like, you shouldn't be taking the pain. It's not good for you. And Yeppe was trying to convince me. And at the end, I agreed that I will get the epidural. And then I got the epidural. And after that, I slept for a few hours. That's the only sleep that I got. And I woke up with pain. It was February 27, early in the morning, around 5 o'clock. I woke up with pain, saying that, oh, the epidural didn't work. And then they checked, the epidural was still there. Like, there was still some dosage of epidural, and And then the midwife checked the progress and she said, oh, you are almost fully dilated. And we waited for almost like half an hour or something, and I was fully dilated. And the progress from I think 6 to 10 centimeters was very fast. The last night when they checked, I was still only 4 centimeter. It was only 5 centimeter. And then they said, oh, it could easily be another day or so. And we were like another day with this pain. I really was not ready for any more pain. And 5 in the morning when they checked, I was almost fully progressed, and I even progressed much faster from 9 to 10 centimeters in just half an hour. And the midwife told me, you are ready to push. And then I remember saying a little prayer, and I said, I can do this for him. I can do this for him. And I started pushing. Yippee was holding my hand. And there he was born. Elliot was born February 27th at 6:06 in the morning in Danish time. The first thing is there was no baby cry. The only cry that echoed in the room was mine. And Elliot came out and he was given to me. He had his little hand under his chin with the other supporting his arm. And there was no words to describe that moment. And it was the moment I gave birth to my motherhood. Not in the way that I hoped for. I still didn't know why. I was thinking this is so morbid to give birth to a child who died. But when he came out and he was given to me, I just looked at him and there was this love, the love that I felt at that moment. I don't think I've ever felt that ever in my life. Even after 4 years, when I think about that moment, that a mother holds her baby, whether alive or dead, is so precious. He just looked like he was sleeping. There is no baby cry. Only cry that they could hear was mine. He looked so, so peaceful. He looked so peaceful. His head was a bit bumped. And usually that happens for babies when they come through your birth canal. You can see his skin was a bit peeled and his lips were a bit darker. And he looked so, 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 so peaceful. He had my nose. The nose looked like mine. And his hands and feet, it was really long. And he was quite a long baby. He was thin, but he was very long. He weighed 500 grams less than what he's supposed to weigh for his gestation. But lengthwise, he was still tall for his, he was still long for his gestation. And next they have to, it's the afterbirth and the placenta came out and the midwife said something. The placenta is small and it has quite some blood clots in it. And they noted this. They're going to take some notes about it. And send it further. And I, at this point, I was still holding Elliot. I was looking at him. There were so many tears. And Yippee also got a chance. And Yippee is the one who cut the umbilical cord. And and it was placed on my chest. And within a few minutes of him being placed in the chest, I could feel the warmth turning into cold. It's really scary how fast it went from his body being warm to being cold. And I asked for some ice packs to lay him down on some ice packs, so I was given that. There's no words to describe those few moments that I felt with him. And I also snapped at Yepe, saying that you should call the parents because I wanted them to see him quite fresh. And it really sounds weird to say this, but how their skin fades away in few hours, it goes fast. And Yepi called. By the time I also called my family in India, and this is where it was very strange, because the Danish hospitals, they encouraged me to hold him. We could stay with him in the hospital as much as we want. We could take him outdoors. There was cuddle cots that we could actually, that was transportable. We could take him out on walks. And until the funeral time, we could have him with us. And until we give him for autopsy, we could have him. And we decide how long we should be with him. And in India, many mothers don't even get a chance to hold their baby. The baby is immediately taken away from the mother. And if you hear my interview with Kavita, we actually talk about these things, how India handles baby loss and grief. And it's quite devastating how Indians perceive grief. Even though my family has gone through first-hand baby loss, the response that I got from family was like, oh, give him back immediately. Do not hold him for a long time. Just give him back. God is going to give you another baby. For now, give him back. Give him back. Those are the things that I heard while I'm still holding Elliot. And for me, why shouldn't I hold my baby? Like it's a very motherly instinct to hold the baby and to spend time with him. Like I am his mother. Like I gave birth to him. And to ask me not to hold my son, I did not take that well. And I sang some songs for him. We got to spend another day and a half with him in the hospital. This is one of the biggest regrets that I have. We did not bathe him. They took some handprints and footprints, and throughout and from the time he was born until now, the midwife said, take the pictures. They encouraged us to take the pictures. I thought, like, why would I need any memory of this? And the midwife advised us, even if you're going to look at those or not, it will be good for you to have these pictures. So the midwives took the camera and they took some pictures of the birth, and also while we held him in our arms. So they've been taking some pictures all along. And we've been also given two octopus, little octopus. It is given as donations in the hospital for NICU babies and also for the babies who are still born. And those two crochets, little octopus, was given to us. And they also gave a very fine wedding cloth that we could wrap him in. I also learned that those are donated wedding cloth. They are made into nice dresses, or it is just given us a piece of cloth. And what we got was this piece of cloth, that a very fine white cloth that we could wrap him in. And unfortunately, the cloth, the dress that I bought for Elliot was quite too big for him. And so it was also the hospital clothes that he wore, also donated to the hospitals. It was winter, so we gave him a soft sweater kind of thing and a blue striped hat. And then we wrapped him in this fine wedding cloth. And we had him on the... it is a cuddle cot. One more thing that happened after birth, before my parents-in-law came, they also rolled in breakfast table. One of the Danish traditions that is super weird is the Danish flags are everywhere. Whether you want to celebrate someone's birthday, whether there's a wedding, whether there's an anniversary, for anything and everything, it's celebrated with Danish flags. And so on the breakfast table, there are some juice, there's some bread, and there was also a Danish flag. And when it was rolled in, I actually thought the person who came in has mistakenly come to a wrong room, because we are mourning in this room. We are not celebrating anything. And then I gave a very weird look of like, what is going on? There is this flag and celebration. In that moment, as much weird as it felt, it also felt quite nice. And I really liked the acknowledgement that they gave for Elliot's life. I had the breakfast and he was there in the room. And there was Danish flags. So for a moment, it felt like a celebration. He was just napping. I could easily close my eyes and think that he was just napping and I was having my breakfast and he's going to wake up any moment. It still hasn't synced in. Even after giving birth to him, it still hasn't synced that he had died. I'm still hoping that he will wake up and cry. And then they moved us to this other ward, maternity ward. I did not hear any other babies cry. It was still isolated, and we were told like we could spend as much time as we with him. And they gave this little octopus, and we got some clothes for him. We spent some time with him, and they had a transportable cuddle cots that if you want to take him home. And then we decided not to bring him home. It didn't feel quite right for us to bring him home just to take him back. So we decided that we're going to stay with him the whole 27th. On the 28th, then we will give him for autopsy and come back home. So we spent that whole day with him, and the next day we took some last photos. And when we signaled, and that's the thing, you can never be ready for how much time you want to spend with him. You could easily spend another week with him, or there will always be not enough time. And to decide that, okay, in a few hours we're going to leave him. And they told us, signal us when you're ready, and then we will come and we will roll the stroller out of the room. So Ippi and I held him for one last time, took a few pictures, and we signaled that we were ready. And then they came in. And the last thing that I did was quickly exchange the octopus crochet. So I took the one that he slept with, and I gave him the one that I slept with. We quickly exchanged the crochet, and he was rolled out while we looked at it. So we looked at the stroller being rolled away, and he was going to the autopsy. So to conclude, the only people that have actually seen him is me, Yippe's parents, and my friends visited in the hospital, and it's the midwives and the doctors, and it's so nice. It's beautiful to look back and think about those moments, because the doctors, whenever the midwives, they came to visit our room, they asked for his name. They described him, how he looked like me, and some of the features, how he looked like Yippe. And the conversation that they had around him, they made me feel comfortable to hold him. And they told me nothing is right or wrong, just do you. And those things I really appreciate. The Danish system helped me breathe and spend time with Danyard. I will never, ever, ever forget those moments. And that really helped me in the future, to in the aftermath of the loss. It really helped me grieve, and it also helped me move forward. I know women, they live in so much regret, not knowing how their child looked, or not knowing their gender, not knowing, there's so much not knowing, not being able to hold them, not being able to kiss them. And I'm really happy that I got enough time with him. There will never be enough time, but at least I got to be with him for a couple of days. And I'm really grateful that at that point I lived in Denmark, and this Danish system helped me grieve in a very healthy way. Yeah, after he rolled away, it was time for us also to leave the hospital. We were getting discharged, and I left the hospital carrying the bag that I brought in with his handprint and footprint and the crochet that he slept with. Very few memories and a camera full of photos. And no baby. No one should experience it. And yet so many parents go through this, getting out of the hospital with empty arms, with nothing but just memories. The last ritual that we did before we left the hospital was to go to this live tree. It's a big board in the hospital where for every child that is born, you do a ritual of pinning a leaf or an apple or a butterfly, depending on how they are born. For example, for girls, it's a light green leaf, and for boys, it's a dark green leaf. And for the babies that has never seen the light of the day, for the stillborn babies, you put a butterfly, and for the twins, you put an apples, and for the babies that are born at home, you put snails. And we went in, so we picked a butterfly, and then we pinned the butterfly on the tree, and took a picture with the tree. And that was the last thing that we did before we left the hospital. And then with our empty arms, we came home. So that is his bird story and the time that we spent with him and a little bit about his pregnancy. I really hope you will join for the next one where I talk about when we picked him up from the autopsy, his funeral, and what happened with the postpartum, and what did we find in those autopsy results. So stay with me and I'll meet you in the next episode. And thank you so much for listening to our story so far. See you in the next one.